Okay, thank you. Anyways, okay.
Yes.
Nice to see you. Great. Welcome, everybody. It's 11:01, so we're going to get started. On behalf of Torah Moshe, I want to welcome everybody. Welcome back, Rabbi Dweck, after his fascinating lecture, part one, on pre-enlightenment or in general on Sephardic Jewry. Vakasha, part two. Rabbi Dweck, you can start right away.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. And good to see everyone again. To continue the, you know, this discussion around how enlightenment affected the Sephardic Jews in general. And so, as I said last time, what I'd like to do this time is to look at the aftermath, right? What happens as a result of being sidelined by the, or during the Enlightenment, and where you just do not have an interaction with it. You don't have the effects of what it does to the world and certainly to the Jewish people. And so, you know, we recognize that one of the things that happened, at least in the Ashkenazi world, one of the many things that happened in the Ashkenazi world, is that it produced this opening for the Reform movement. Yeah, and where there was a desire to be more engaged with the world, there was a sense that the current or the then system of traditional Torah was not providing an appropriate interface with the world and the thought of the world and where it was that the world was going. And so that was one of the responses. And when we look at in terms of the Sfaradim, these upheavals, right? These elements that really shook the nature of Jewish life were simply not reaching, you know, the Sfaradim and where it was that they were. And so they carried on. But what ended up happening as a result of finally entering the West, right? And there are various points, right, in terms of this. And I'm going to say again, I am not saying this and presenting this as a historian. I am not a historian. I am simply looking at this from a conceptual point of view, from the back, right? After looking at all of it having happened, looking backwards, what is it that it looks like from that perspective? And again, I don't know if there are people here who were not at the previous lecture, right? So I will just say these things before I get on in terms of who I am, right? And I don't mean, you know, I mean just in terms of my life experience with regards to these things. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I consider myself very much a Western person, right? A Western thinking person. I know only a Western world. And last time I spent some time talking about, however, the Eastern influences in my life. The fact that I'm a Syrian, you know, I'm a Jew that has family on both sides, my mother and father's sides, that originate at least in the last 500 years in Aleppo, Syria, and those influences in my life. And so I in my own self, in my person, in my being, in my learning, I am a confluence. I am a mixture of East and West. But in terms of my thought, I am a Western thinker. I am a Western person. I have grown up only knowing the West. And so the reality is that as I look back and make sense of what it is that has occurred and what has been handed down to me and the Jewish world in which I have been, not only I've been given, but that I, within which I find myself, you know, what is it that created the circumstances? So these are my observations, right? These are my empirical observations. So what ends up happening is you have a situation in which the state of Israel is established, right? And Jews are now coming into the state of Israel. And of course, overwhelmingly, because the state is established by Ashkenazi Jews, secular Ashkenazi Jews, the government, the system of the state is very much governed by European thought. Yeah, it's very much governed by European thought, European procedure, European milieu, and atmosphere. And in Israel, you have these Jews that have been there for some time, right? You know, what we would call, for lack of a better term, Sephardic Jews, that are there before the state is established. Like I said, you know, for example, you have Yeshivat Porat Yosef. The Yeshivat Porat Yosef was in Jerusalem for years and years, before decades, before the state of Israel was established. Some of the great rabbis of our times in the 20th century and even before studied in Porat Yosef. Some examples of this, Chacham Ezra Atiyeh. Chacham Ezra Atiyeh was the Rebbe of not only Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, but of many of the great Sephardic rabbis of the 20th century. Hacham Ezra Atiyah was also from Aleppo, and he was the head of the yeshiva. But he believed, and in Porat Yosef, for example, right, they were all there in Israel, in the land of Israel, before the state was established, living their lives, living as Jews, you know, obviously not under Jewish government, but nonetheless living as Jews. And what they found was during at the time that the state was established, that there was a tremendous difference between the way that Ashkenazi Jews, and I mean, even though the state was established by secular Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews, the Ashkenazi rabbis, the Ashkenazi Orthodox, you know, communities that came into Israel were very different than the Sephardic Jews that were already living in Israel. Because remember, of course, Israel is in the East. And so they were able to carry on as they were in the East. An example of this, just, you know, a personal example, Rav Ovadia Yosef was born in Baghdad. And he moved to Israel when he was 4 years old. And he lived there, his family from Baghdad and so many other Iraqi families lived in Israel exactly as they did in Baghdad. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't that different. The culture, the mindset, the whole atmosphere and structure of life. The problem was, is that when the Ashkenazi Jews came from Europe to Israel, and there was a whole constituency that did, and established their yeshivot in Israel and called these yeshivot after the cities in which they lived in Europe, right? Ponovich, you know, Vyshnitz and all of these places that were now being reestablished in the new state. It created a sense of, and I'm going to use a strong word over here, it created a sense of self-consciousness among the Sephardic Jews that were living there. Because they were seen by the Ashkenazic Jews, and I mean even the religious Ashkenazic Jews, as being uneducated, uncultured, uncouth, right? That they were just not up to par with everyone else. And one of the reasons for that was, even though it wasn't spoken outright, is because they had not gone through the Enlightenment. And so even though someone like, for example, right, Rav Elyoshiv, or someone like Rav Shach, yeah, Zichronam Livracha, wouldn't necessarily say this outright, that they would say that it was the Enlightenment that made the difference between the Sfarim and Ashkenazim, they nonetheless definitely saw the Torah of Ashkenaz, the Torah of their yeshivot, as being superior to the Torah of the yeshivot of the Sfaradim. And there's an interesting line that I'll read for you. Bear with me 1 minute. But this I'm going to grab this from my library. So what I'm holding over here is a copy of Rav Ovadia Yosef's Yabia Omer, right? This is the second volume of the Yabia Omer. The Yabia Omer of Rav Ovadia Yosef was his major magnum opus of tshuvot, of responsa that he wrote. And Rav Ovadia in his own right, I mean, he was an absolute genius as far as his knowledge of Jewish law. And I had mentioned him last time about the story of Rabbi Uri and Rabbi Simcha Wasserman, which I'm not going to repeat today, but you'll remember if I did. And, you know, there is this amazing point that he writes in the book. That he has these approbations, right? He has these haskamot in the book, yeah. That he puts in the second version and the second volume. I'm going to show it to you. Right, all of these little paragraphs are letters. So I don't know if you read Hebrew, but you can see, you know, he has letters from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, which I'm going to read to you. He has letters from Rav Elyashiv. He has letters from a whole bunch of the gedolim, Rav Reuven Katz. Right, I don't know if you know who Rav Reuven Katz was. Yeah, over here. Rav Reuven Katz. Rav Reuven Katz, by the way, was the Av Bet Din of Petach Tikva. And Rav Ovadia sat with Rav Reuven Katz on that Bet Din in Petach Tikva when he was 24 years old. He was already a member of the Bet Din. And Rav Ovadia said to me that there were three people that he met in his life, three Talmidei Hachamim that he met in his life, that he experienced in talking with them, that they genuinely had Kol HaTorah Kula on their fingertips, which means that they had the whole of Torah on their fingertips, meaning at full access at all times. Who were they? He said, Rav Svi Pesach Frank, who was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, Rav Reuven Katz was one of them, yeah? And Rav Reuven Katz sat with Rav Reuven Katz on the Beit Din for many, many, many years. And he said that Rav Reuven Katz knew Kol HaTorah Kula on his fingertips. Rav Moshe. That's who he said. Rav Moshe Feinstein was the third one. So I want to read for you something that Rav Shlomo Zalman wrote in his approbation to Rav Ovadia, which seems to be, and Rav Shlomo Zalman was always a very close friend of Rav Ovadia, right? Rav Ovadia Yosef. And Rav Ovadia respected him tremendously, tremendously. But there's something in this approbation that he writes that tells you something about the way that even the greatest and most open and most faithful and embracing of the Talmidei HaChamim of the time saw the Sfardim. So listen to what he writes. So this is Rav Shlomo Zalman, right? Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach writes to him. He says, "Ve'amadti kimishtomem al hayashrut ve'abikiyut ha'atzuma hamatimot yachad." He said, "I was absolutely astonished in reading your response," and he's talking to Rav Ovadia Yosef, right? "On the clear, straight, and not only the straight logic and treatment of the law that you have, but the bikiyut ha'atzuma, but the massive expertise you have in your broad knowledge of the legal corpus itself," right? He says, and they come together. Sometimes you have people that have very broad knowledge, but they don't know how to treat it. And sometimes you have people that have very good treatments of knowledge. They don't have a broad base. You have a massive database and you have a tremendous fluency of the legal system. And then he says, "V'sefer zehayali l'simchat ha'chag." He got it right before Pesach. He said, "I got it. It was like it was the simcha of the chag for me." And then he says this. He says, "Ach mishne simcha samachti." He goes, "But there's the double simcha that I have in receiving your sefer. Lirot ben achenu asfaradim gavra rabba dechavate. To see that among the Sfardim, there's somebody like you." What does that mean? Right? Does that mean that there's nobody, that the Sfardim, it's Rav Shlomo Zalman essentially saying that he was happy to see something that he didn't expect, right? That he didn't expect that among the Sfardim there should be somebody of the caliber of Rav Ovadia Yosef, right? And the truth of the matter is that there was nobody like Rav Ovadia Yosef among the Ashkenazim either, right? There was just nobody like him, full stop, period, as we say. But that didn't mean that there were not tremendous Talmidei HaChamim among the Sfardim. It's just that they weren't seen that way. I'll tell you another story. And this story, by the way, normally I wouldn't tell this story, but I'm going to tell it to you in this context because it also shows how the impact, and I chalk this up to the impact of the Enlightenment, right? I chalk this up not just to basic prejudices, right? But to the impact of the Enlightenment. And that is, again, at the establishment of the state, not long after that, Rav Ezra Atiyah, who I mentioned was the Rosh Yeshiva of Porat Yosef. And this is, by the way, this is a story that I did not hear secondhand, right? This is a story that I heard firsthand. Yeah, so I'm not telling stories here that are just, you know, boba mices, as they say, which is a very Sephardic term. But, you know, so don't tell anybody that I use that term. I'm telling you stories that I heard firsthand. And this is the story. It was told to me by the now Rishon Lezion, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, who was the son of Rav Ovadia Yosef. And I heard him say it in front of Rav Ovadia. And this was the story. So that Chacham Ezra Atiyah, who was the Rosh Yeshiva Porat Yosef, recognized that there was value at the time in establishing a political party that was a Torah-oriented political party. and that he believed that it would be right and worthwhile to be able to speak together with the Ashkenazim, to be able to form a unified party that was faithful to traditional Torah Judaism. So who did Rav Ezra Atiyah go to meet to speak about this? The Chazon Ish. So he goes to see the Chazon Ish, and he brings with him his best young student, Rav Ovadia Yosef, right? And so Rav Ovadia Yosef and Rav Ezra Atiyah go to speak to the Chazon Ish, and who is with the Chazon Ish? Rav Shach was with the Chazon Ish. And Rav Shach and Rav Ovadia at the time were both young students. And they sat to discuss perhaps establishing a unified party, and it never got off the ground. The reason why it never got off the ground is because the Chazon Ish refused to speak with them. And I'm not saying this in any disparaging way, chas v'shalom, against the Chazon Ish, but I'm simply saying it as a matter of fact story. The Chazon Ish decided not to speak with them. And the only reason that he didn't speak with them was because they didn't speak Yiddish. And the Chazon Ish didn't feel that he could have a proper dialogue with them because they didn't speak Yiddish. And he said, Mamaloshen, they're not speaking Mamaloshen. So he said, we can't, it's difficult to converse this way. And Chacham Ezra Atiyah said, okay, it seems like it's going to be too difficult for us to try and have a conversation around this. And it never got off the ground. And that was very much indicative of the way that the worlds of the Sfaradim and the Ashkenazim were running in Israel, right? And what was going on in Israel was you had these European Talmidei Chachamim that had gone through the ruptures and ravages of the Enlightenment, that they had to literally fight for their lives in order to be able to maintain themselves through. And you end up seeing these people that are the Sfaradim, that are sitting in Israel, that had no clue about any of the sophistry, right, of the sophistication of thought, of the nuanced nature of how it was that these things needed to be addressed. And so what ended up happening as a result of that was, on the one hand, the Sfaradim were not necessarily recognized as being able to maintain levels on par with the Ashkenazim. And I'm going to say that is not necessarily false. It is possible and very likely, and indeed there, it's true, that they were not on par. And the reason they were not on par was because they had not experienced what each other experienced. The issue that was problematic, unfortunately, was that there was not a respect for the difference. Right? There was not a respect for what it was. What did this Faradim have? What was unique and special to them? What did matter to them? What aspect of approach to the Torah did they have that perhaps the Ashkenazim might learn from? But that was not opened at the time. That was not something that could be embraced at the time, and wasn't embraced at the time. And as a result of that, the Ashkenazim found themselves, you know, to definitely be the larger number. They also found themselves to be in a much more powerful place, right, in terms of the, you know, the politics of it all. You know, heaven forbid we use that word, but it's a word that is an important word to use, because even though it is a word that is tainted with negativity, all politics means is who is managing the elements of power. That's what politics are. And any time that you have human beings in any aggregate, you have politics. You have politics in your family, you have politics in your school, you have politics at work, you have politics everywhere. Because if you have human beings, you have questions of power. And that's always the case. So anybody knows who has a family with kids, the two-year-old is the one who holds all of the power. And he is the one that wields the massive measure of politics. But that's all that it is. And so the bottom line was who was in power? And how did that power manifest? And the reality was that the Ashkenazim were very much in power, and their power definitely manifested in their hands. And unfortunately, the Sfaradim did not know how to be able to live in that world as they were. Yes, I want to repeat that. The Sfaradim did not know how to maintain themselves in the milieu, right, in the atmosphere, in the environment, the Weltanschauung, whatever it is that you want to call it, right? The mindset of the Ashkenazi Torah world was not a place that the Sfaradi felt comfortable, was not a place that the Sfaradi felt even that he or she measured up. And to a certain degree, they didn't, because of the differences of experience and what it is that the Ashkenazim went through as opposed to what it was that the Sfaradim went through. Now, instead of maintaining, because that created a very strong sense of self-consciousness, the response to this was that the Sfaradim felt that they needed to come into the Ashkenazi world as Ashkenazim as much as they could, in order to be able to be embraced by the dominant Torah lens or Torah mindset or Torah view that was running now at the time. And so they began to dress the way that the Ashkenazi rabbis dressed, and they began to speak the way that the Ashkenazi Talmidei Chachamim spoke, and they began to learn even in the systems that the Ashkenazi Talmidei Chachamim learned, and they abandoned their own. Because they realized, or they recognized, or felt, right or wrong, that if they were to maintain their own system, they would be lost. They would have no room anymore within the Medina. And so what they did was realizing that this system in Israel, right, was for all intents and purposes now a Western system. They, as we say in Hebrew, lo matzu yedehem veragleihem ve'bet ha-midrash. They didn't have their footing. They couldn't get their bearings in that new environment, and in that new system that was for all intents and purposes foreign to them. And so, you know, there was a great deal of self-consciousness at the time. And as a result of that, the only place that anyone could go, even to get any element of, you know, Torah learning that might have been old school Sfaradi, as we may call it, and even that was very different than some other strains of Sfaradi approach and learning, was Porat Yosef. But it was only a matter of time before Porat Yosef itself changed its curriculum, changed its focus and approach to learning to run in tandem and coincide with how the Ashkenazi approach to learning was. I'm not going to get into today what was different about the actual systems, yeah? But the systems were very different. The way that we learn Gemara, the way that we approach a sugya in the Talmud, a particular portion of study in the Talmud, was quite different. And so it ended up being that there was a very strong self-consciousness among the Sfaradim in Israel. And so you have today, you know, if a rabbi is not necessarily speaking in those terms, dressing in those terms, thinking in those terms, teaching in those terms, they are not looked at as measuring up. And this gets to a point where there is genuine prejudice in that world, in where you have, you know, for example, Ashkenazi yeshivot that have quotas as to how many Sfardim they are allowed to accept. Yeah, and that runs till today. It's just now beginning to wane a bit. But even though that the official quotas are beginning to wane, the mindsets are not. And so that created a very strong dissonance between the Sfaradim and Ashkenazim. And it also meant that the Sfaradim would never really catch up, right? That they would try very much to be able to do it. Now, there is one thing that I would like to say that's important for us to understand. I'm talking about a very specific aspect of the Jewish world, yeah? What we know now as the Haredi world, yeah, is what it is that I'm talking about, which is not at all the entirety of Jewish life, right, in Israel, but it's a very major part of it. And even in the Haredi world, and why is this important? Why am I saying this? Because one thing that we know about the Haredi world until today is that they are, at least officially, right, if not practically, shun secular learning, right? Shun learning outside of Torah. And so it's a question as well, who cares about the Enlightenment? I mean, if all you're doing is learning Torah, well, what does it matter? I mean, that's all the Sfaradim were doing as well. Yes, perhaps. but one must not underestimate the effects of the Enlightenment, even in the approach to Torah learning, and how it is that Torah is studied, and the nuances and sophistication of how it is the Torah is studied. That definitely affects. And the way that people live their lives definitely affect. I believe that because the Sfaradim that of whom I'm speaking, right, the world of which I'm speaking, never had an opportunity really to be able not only to study, you know, secular learning, not that they would want to, they also weren't impacted by the influx or by the power of the world itself moving into a new system of secular thought and knowledge, of scientific thought, of philosophical thought, of psychological thought, that the Ashkenazim in Europe could not avoid. They were experienced, their experiences absorbed it, whether they liked it or not, and they responded to it in all manner of ways, ways that were conscious and ways that were subconscious. But the Sfaradim didn't experience that. So that's today, right, what's going on in Israel. We'll talk about the next time, because the next time we're going to talk about what's our situation now in terms of how it is that those things run. What I want to do is I want to look at the United States also in terms of how it is that this ended up manifesting. So Israel is one thing, and that's what went on in Israel. And I can tell you that you know, this complex of being inferior ran very strong and still does till this day run very strong. The interesting thing is that it's now depicted on television programs in Israel. Yeah, in all different ways. There's all kinds of television programs that show the differences between the Sfaradim and Ashkenazim and how it is that they're how they related to and so on and so forth, which you may or may not have seen. What happens in the United States of America also is that the number of Jews that, you know, that are in the United States are far greater, you know, Ashkenazim than there are Sfaradim. And the Sfaradim also come to America and have no knowledge of how to live in the West, right? So that's also something that the Ashkenazim have. Even though the Ashkenazim called it the New World, and it was, you know, this brand new place, the United States of America. Many of the rabbis at the time, the leading rabbis in Europe, you know, thought that it was a terrible, you know, impure place, not like the old world, and, you know, the old cities. But there is one thing that is unquestionable, and that is that the United States was Western, and that Europe was Western, and the move from Germany, Poland, what have you, right, to the United States of America may have been a major culture shock. Indeed, it was. But it doesn't come close to the culture shock of moving from Baghdad to New York, or from moving from Aleppo to New York. That's a completely different world in all facets and in all manners. And so what you have is, again, Ashkenazim in the United States that are learning to live in the West, right? But they've lived in the West. So what they're really learning to do is to learn to live in the new world as opposed to the old world. But the Western mindset, they don't realize how little the curve is, right? It's not a massive learning curve. There's a learning curve. It's not massive. And certainly not as massive as it is to come from Aleppo to New York or to come from Baghdad to New York. When again, you have not experienced what the West is and how the Enlightenment transformed the West. Not to mention, I mean, we haven't spoken here. This is about Enlightenment specifically. We're not really looking at how it is that the Holocaust affected all of this massively. But it works in tandem. And so what you have in the West, for example, yeah, there was a very strong influence in, at least in you know, mainstream, middle of the road, not necessarily secular, but certainly secular Jewish families, for higher education. Higher education wasn't a question. I mean, it was something that was done in Europe, and it was something that was done in the United States, and you sent your children to university. And this was happening in the 30s and 40s, you know, when people came into the United States and post-war, there was no question. Of course, people, you know, children of Ashkenazic families were going to to study, and they took the studies of academia, right? They took academic study very seriously. So, you know, you look, for example, I don't know how many people have heard of it, but the Yeshiva of Flatbush in New York, right? Which is now already, I think, 100 years old. Yeah, if I'm not mistaken. When I was there, I was 80 years old. So it's probably by now already close to 100 years old. Joel Braverman, you know, Yeshiva of Flatbush. It was established early on. And the level of academics was very, very high. And that was the major reason for it was because the Ashkenazim ran it. Sfaradim that moved to the United States did not look at higher education as paramount. They didn't even understand it. Certainly, I can say for certain, right, the Syrian community, because there were some differences between the, you know, the communities of Iraq and Baghdad, and various countries. But for the most part, Middle Eastern Jews did not consider formal education as part of the system. Right, you have to remember that that's very much part of Western society and Western thought. Even in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, it was very much, at least in Western Europe, it was definitely part of how it was that people ran. And so, I'm looking at this. Yes, I don't think I use the words inferior or contaminated, but thank you. And so the problem was, is that the Sfaradim, the Jews from Aleppo, for example, or many of the Jews from the Middle East, for them, once a person finished basic education, it was time to go into business. And that was the way that children, you know, were taught, that the boys went into business and the girls got married as soon as they were able to get married or of age to get married. And that was the way that things ran. Certainly I can speak of in the Syrian community, I mean, until at least 10 years ago. And it was only slowly, slowly that there were certain students, certain families that encouraged their children to go for higher education. But it was definitely frowned upon in the community. It was looked at as a waste of time in the community. And they didn't understand why should we be doing anything else when you can be going into business and you can be getting married, you can be starting your family, and that's the way that things should be. And as a result of that, and this is important, right, because there are many strands that I could draw from as a result of that, but one that I want to look at is in terms of education. There was also a self-consciousness among the Sfaradim in the United States. There was self-consciousness over the fact that they were not measuring up in terms of how it was that they were doing their own Judaism. And one of the ways that this manifested, one of the very strong ways that this manifested was in the day school movement, right? So I talked about the Yeshiva of Flatbush and, you know, students that, young students, right? That were going to Jewish day schools, or if not Jewish day schools, going in the older days to Talmud Torah, you know, after they were going to regular school, were educated by Ashkenazim. And the reason for that is because Sfaradim were not creating any educational environments. They were not really creating schools within which they could study. You know, their children could study their own ways or their customs or their approaches to Torah and so on. Their children, like I said, were going into business. They were not, certainly not encouraging me. If anything, if their child wanted to be, you know, a professional of some sort, a lawyer, a doctor, you know, an accountant, something like that, that they begrudgingly accepted. But if a student wanted to become a teacher, that wasn't something that was done. Certainly not done. And certainly it was not encouraged that children should go into the rabbinate. That you would have to like have your head examined for in Sephardi societies. I'm not saying that this wasn't the case among Ashkenazim, but perhaps the numbers of, you know, of population, just the population itself was large enough so that you had at least some people that were coming out among the Ashkenazim that were becoming rabbis, were becoming teachers, becoming scholars. And so Interesting. I'm just seeing, I'm sorry, but you know, when these questions come up in the middle of my talk or when these comments come up in the middle of the talk, I have to look at this, but I'm going to look at
I'd leave the comments till the end.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it till the end. I get distracted. I should shut them because I get distracted touch sometimes. So because there was no encouragement among the Sephardi Jews for their children to become rabbis and for their children to become educators, there were no Sephardic educators and no Sephardic rabbis, and for that matter, no Sephardic institutions of education that kept the customs, that kept the practice, that kept the philosophy running and alive. And so I can tell you again, my own personal experience, you know, I saw in the comments, somebody mentioned the Sephardic Hebrew Academy. Sephardic Hebrew Academy was a Jewish day school started by my father and grandfather in Los Angeles. And I went there. And even in the Sephardic Hebrew Academy, this is what it was called, Sephardic Hebrew Academy. Even in the Sephardic Hebrew Academy, all of the teachers were Ashkenazi, right? And the only thing really that was done was that the reading, right, was done in Sephardic accent. But outside of that, everything that was taught in terms of how it was that the Ashkenazim ran, right? How the Ashkenazim did things. And the way that I experienced this from basically, you know, 5 to 13 years old was that I was taught certain things in Sephardic Hebrew Academy in my class, and I would go home and nothing that I was taught or very little of what I was taught was actually done in my home. It wasn't done there. I'll give you an example, right? A few examples that I'll give you. One example is, you know, and this has to do with the difference between what's actually written in halakhic books and practice, something that Professor Chaim Soloveitchik points out in his famous Rupture and Reconstruction, what he calls mimetic Judaism as opposed to textually based Judaism. Mimetics meaning it's passed down, you know, in terms of practice and behavior. And so, so it's taught, right, that how do you light Hanukkah candles? You light Hanukkah candles, if you can, in the window to the public, right, to the public street. And if you can't do that, you light it by the doorway opposite the mezuzah so that you're surrounded in mitzvot. And that's codified, right? That's something that's definitely written. And I would go home, both my parents, my maternal grandparents' house, my paternal grandparents, my parents, where they light it, inside on the table, in the living room, you know, or in the dining room, you know, they light it on the credenza or on the table inside. And I would say, you know, we're supposed to light it by the window. We don't do that. Well, why don't we do that? Well, the reality is whatever the origins were, whether we were in danger, whether we were embarrassed, we were afraid, we were concerned people would see, whatever the case may be. Yeah, it's known that there was issues with regards to this throughout, not only Sephardic, but nonetheless, that's how my family continued to do it. That's how the entire Syrian community continued to do it. And I learned that this was the way that it was supposed to be done, but the way that I was doing it at home wasn't right. It wasn't appropriate. And I became embarrassed to say in class that what I did at home wasn't like what the teacher was saying. And very often, I mean, unfortunately, now I'm more aware, you know, often the teachers were not necessarily educated either. You know, they received the curriculum, they taught what was written in their curriculum, and that's all they knew. If all of a sudden you had a question from a student that said, I don't do this, they say, well, you're doing it wrong. That's all they knew. It's not what's written over here. And that's how things happen. Not only that, forget about, you know, how the laws were taught. Practice was different. No Sephardic Orthodox people that I knew in my community, in my place growing up, in New York growing up, wore a kippah. It was not done. It wasn't something that was done. Orthodox men didn't wear a kippah on a regular basis. When did we wear a kippah? If we were eating, if you went into shul, if you needed to say a bracha or something. And usually what would happen was, even if you needed to say a bracha, they would go like this and say the bracha and eat. Yeah, they would cover it with their sleeve or something like that. That's what was done. That was what was done. But the interesting thing is, and I know this happened among some Ashkenazi communities, but in the modern Orthodox, classic Jewish day school world in the United States, if you did not wear a kippah, it was tantamount to being irreligious. And so they used to have, you know, they had like these, you know, the fabric yarmulkes that you get in bulk. They would have to have them in the school because all the Sephardic kids would come to school. They never had a kippah. Not only that, that's with the kids or with the general population. The Sfaradim in the Middle East, the rabbis didn't wear kippot because the rabbis also went to work. I was just saying in one of my shiurim the other day, I was giving a shiur in one of the tshuvot of Rabbi Matlub Abadi. Rabbi Matlub Abadi was one of the major rabbis, one of the major Talmidei Chachamim in the Brooklyn Syrian community at the turn of the century when they were established, you know, and for some time, he died in 1970, and he was a rabbi there for a very, very long time, very strong Talmid Chacham. He was the, so Rabbi Ezra Atiyah that I mentioned before, who was the Rosh Yeshiva Porat Yosef, was the Talmid Chaver, was a student, essentially, of Matlub Abadi, of Rabbi Matlub Abadi. Rabbi Matlub Abadi was a tremendous Talmid Chacham. But when he moved to New York, he ended up going into business. Not only did he teach on Shabbat and so on, he went into business. And my father was with him. He would drive him to the city. They were lived in Brooklyn. He would drive him to work in the morning in the city, to the city, to his office, to Rabbi Matlub Abadi's office. And Rabbi Matlub would get into the car. He would take his kippah off and say, okay, let's go. Because he was going to work. He didn't wear a kippah. And many of the hachamim, they didn't wear the kippah all the time. It wasn't something that was it was custom and done. So there were these many, many, many differences that we began to feel very self-conscious about because it wasn't what was done in the larger, more established community of the Ashkenazim. And we and I do think very strongly that the as a result of not experiencing the impact of the Enlightenment. And it's not the only strand. Again, I don't think it's the only thing. I would never simplify things to that degree, but I think it is a massive, massive aspect of it. We didn't have dialogue. We didn't have dialogue. We didn't have response to that level. And the reality is it's only now that I look, for example, at the Syrian community and I see that they are now completely, now much more embracing higher education. Their children are regularly going to university and getting degrees. It's taken a century for that to be able to catch up on any real level. And so that's had a tremendous effect in terms of how it is that we've taught, how it is that we've learned, how it is that we've practiced our own Judaism, and for that matter. And so what's happening in this Sephardic world now is that there's a strong feeling among the younger generation that they've lost their culture. They've lost their own practice and way of doing things because there's been such a major influx of this different way, right? Not a better or worse way, but just a different way that the Ashkenazim practiced and looked at, you know, the Sfaradim. I can tell you, I mean, many times I would say in class when I was able to muster up the guts, you know, this is what we do, to one of my Ashkenazi rabbis. And very often they would look at me like I fell off the moon, right? Like I came, you know, from outer space. Like, what is that? How could, what does that even mean? What is that? How does that work? And, you know, people, for example, they'll talk to me about tefillot that everybody knows is said in Shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur among the Ashkenazim. And I'll just say, well, we don't say that. Like Unsana Tokef, right? It's the most famous prayer. We don't say it. We don't say Yizkor. We don't, there's a lot of things we just don't say and Sfaradim don't know. And that's fine. Everybody has different things. But when an Ashkenazi hears that, typically there's this shock, right, that ensues. How could it be that, you know, you don't say those things? And so ultimately, the point of this is that there is now a mixing of all of this culture in the West. Yeah, a mixing of all this culture in the West. I haven't spoken about the Spanish and Portuguese, right? And the Western Sephardim, which I did speak about last time. And they just carried on through all of this, doing their own thing. But I will say that there was a bit of an issue with regards to that because, you know, I said over here, this is just a small tidbit, and then I'll start to look at the questions and comments and so on and so forth. You know, the Sephardic Jews here, the Spanish and Portuguese Jews here in London, were the establishment. They were the first Jews in the country. And so they also felt, and they called themselves this, right? They also felt that they were the aristocracy of British Jewry. And to a large degree, for many years, they were. And so they just carried on doing what they did, and they didn't care. They didn't think so much about what the Ashkenazim were doing in the country. But what ended up happening also was that the Ashkenazim also became, you know, the majority of the population. And the Ashkenazim and the Sfaradim were a minority within the minority, within the minority. And as a result of their, I don't want to say isolation, but as a result of their holding themselves apart and practicing as they did, yeah, throughout, they also suffered from a great deal of intermarriage, because there was no sense that there was any real issue or any trouble with how it was that they were practicing, that they had to become part of a broader Jewish community, that they had to interact in that way. And that was an issue, that was a problem that ended up happening with regards to the Spanish Portuguese Jews. And if it wasn't for a large influx of Iraqi Jews and some Middle Eastern Jews in the 60s, as a result of the 67 war, the community probably, I don't know how many Jews would be left in the community, but that, you know, was a resurgence for the Spanish Portuguese Jews here. But they never had these issues that I'm talking about with regards to the Sfaradim in Israel and in America, because they were always in the West and they did go through the Enlightenment and they dealt with it differently, which I write more about in my paper that was published in Tradition Magazine on the issue. So what I'd like to do next time is talk about now and talk about where we all are now, not just the Sfaradim, and how in this big, for lack of a better term, melting pot, although I don't think it's really a melting pot, in the West, in Canada, the United States, Israel, even here in Britain, when the technology melds us all together, how are we faring? And what is it that's happening? And what is it do we need to be aware of in terms of how it is that the future is going to run with us? And how are our children experiencing things? And how will they look at their Judaism? And so that's something that I'd like to look at in light of what it is that we've discussed next time. And I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts, you know, on that. So with that, I will have a look if it's okay to do that now, and we can look at the
up to the top and go sort of in order. There are a fair number of questions, I guess, starting.
I'll take a look. So start at the top, yeah?
Yeah. With okay. Morris, I guess.
Okay. Oops, sorry.
Yeah.
Hold on a second, my Google. Okay, Google, stop. Okay, sorry, my Google Home is going on. I'm always surprised by the number of Sfaradim that go to Ashkenazi yeshivot. Why does Sfaradi community not support their own yeshivot these days? It's a very complicated problem. There aren't Sfaradi yeshivot because there are not Sfaradim that are educated in a way that are able to teach in Sfaradi yeshivot. What I'm doing now is we've begun an online educational center, essentially, which is teaching, you know, classical Sfaradi approach to Torah and to, Jewish philosophy and Jewish law. And I'm taking advantage of the technological platforms, right, to be able to re-engage that way. But as a head of school, right, I used to be head of school in New York for Barkai Yeshiva Day School. One of the most important jobs of any principal of a school, of any head of school, is to hire teachers. Everything else is ancillary to that. Hire good teachers, because that is where the tires hit the pavement. Who is in the class teaching the children? That's where the education occurs. And the most important part of my job, as far as I was concerned, was to hire good teachers. So the board would encourage me very often to expand more classes per grade, right? The system in the United States, right? So that we have grades and then we have classes within the grades. So maybe you have two second grade classes, three second grade classes. And they wanted me to add more classes to the grades. And I always resisted that because I told them good teachers do not grow on trees. And the more classes that are produced will require me to fill with teachers. And I cannot promise you that I will be able to get you better than mediocre teachers. And I will not be a head of school over mediocre education. And why am I saying that to you? Because it's the same with regards to the yeshivot. In order to be able to have strong Sfaradi yeshivot, you need strong Sfaradi teachers and rabbis. And that is very, very thin on the ground today, even because of everything that I told you, everything that I just spoke about. And so that ultimately is something that we have to work on. Even adopt the yeshiva European garb of black hats and coats. Yeah, they had no choice. I mean, they had a choice, but they needed to connect to something. And they didn't have enough of their own that would be able to survive in the Western world the way that the Ashkenazim did. The Ashkenazim had a much better system and much better capacity to be able to survive in that system. And so if you they had to join. And they wore the uniform that they needed to wear in order to be able to be part of it. Yes, Sina, as he's saying, just mentioning what I said about the online platform of learning. Such differences precede the Enlightenment. Differences between Sephardic and Ashkenazic Torah learning, different types of learning. Yes, you're right that they did precede the Enlightenment. But one was not necessarily better or worse than the other. One was not necessarily stronger or weaker than the other. They were just different. But the Enlightenment changed the leverage completely. It tipped the scales entirely. And it made one have a much greater weight and force and leverage in a Western world. Yeah, at least that's my opinion, not forcing anyone to accept that opinion. I know the quotas still exist, unfortunately. Thank you. Sfaradim should learn in their own yeshivot rather than... I know it's very easy to say that Sfaradim should learn in their own yeshivot. It's not easy to do because you don't have educators. The Sfaradim don't know necessarily how it is. It's very hard to develop. Go find the teachers. You can find me. The teachers will do it. It's very, very difficult. But yes, it is. Let me see. Is really right if there are such quotas, then they are not contaminated. Oh, I see where contaminated inferior comes. Though not my words. How does Sfaradi approach Talmud study differ from Ashkenazic method? I'll give you one example, Susanna. The Sfaradim will look at, let's say, a sugya, right? And they'll look at Rashi. So genuinely, the Sfaradim will spend all of their iyun, right? All of their depth of learning on Rashi alone, right? That's not the only thing, but they can and do very often. Just trying to understand how Rashi understood the discussion in the Talmud. And Rashi's wording at times, right? When Rashi will say, for example, right, klomar, which in Hebrew means in other words, right? So he'll take a phrase from the Talmud and he'll say klomar, in other words, such and such. Well, the first question is, what did Rashi think I was going to think that that phrase from the Talmud meant if he didn't tell me, in other words, X? And I have to understand what it is that he said. And then when I do understand what it is that he said, I have to then read it back into the sugya and understand the whole flow of the sugya, as opposed to reading a sugya and then going to all the Rishonim that said anything on the sugya and hearing all of their opinions and trying to put all of their opinions together, which again is a very broad stroke treatment. But the Sfaradim, it's one example of how the Sfaradim would look at it differently than the Ashkenazim. But it's obviously much more, you know, it requires much more proper, integrated, intricate discussion. I don't know about the record. Okay. Would you differentiate the aristocratic Sephardi leadership like Solomon Sassoon and the money coming from? Yes, I would, as I mentioned at the end. Okay. Perhaps a better word. Yeah, thank you. Yeshiva Flatbush. There you go. My mother-in-law in Ashkenazi was an administrator at Sephardic Hebrew Academy in LA. Many of the, who was it? That's what I want to know. Yeah. Don't know who. Probably at my time. I do know Rabbi Dr. Badugo. Of course I knew. He was the principal at the time that I was there. There were young Syrian women and men that attended Brooklyn College. Yes, yes, there were some. That's the point. They were Yotze Min HaKlal. They were exceptions to the rule. When was Magen David Yeshiva in Brooklyn Center? My father was the first graduating class of Magen David Yeshiva Elementary School. He was born in 1939. And so I would say, he was 13? So 52, around in the 50s. Late 40s, 50s. But it was extremely tough going at the time. Extremely tough going. The people, all many, many members in the community opposed the establishment of the school. The lack of the veneer of the Enlightenment that Ashkenazim had, did it contribute to some difficulty dealing with the government? I don't know. Enlightening. Thank you. Even though many secular government officials and employees may not have looked at the religious sector kindly, they're going to indulge, appeared more modern seeming. Yeah, yeah. True. I can remember being in her office And the Syrian boy saying it was a Syrian minhag not to wear a kippah. It was, it's true. It was a Syrian minhag. We weren't just trying to get out of wearing a kippah. Many older Yiddish circles, there were similar. Yeah. Oftentimes, the Sfaradim did not wear tzitzit either. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah. In the 19th century, I was under the impression in the USA that Sephardic Jews looked down on the German Jews. Yes, but remember which Sephardic Jews you're talking about, Hedda. You're talking about the Spanish and Portuguese that were there from the 1600s. Not the Sephardim. They're also the Spanish, Portuguese, Western Jews. And they did look down on pretty much everyone who came in at the time. Same in the UK, exactly. Spanish, Portuguese. Although I was going to keep putting the outside work probably really started in the 60s, which is generally true of a movement. Yeah, true. Absolutely. But the Sephardim never were part of that. We didn't experience all of that. And then we started to be looked upon as though, you know, it was inferior. Five lives of the enlightened among Sephardim, but didn't the Alliance of Sarayton Vesad bring elements of the enlightenment? They brought elements. And to give you an example, so in Egypt, for example, both boys and girls went to the Alliance. And so they did have some French influence of the enlightenment. There's no question about it, but nothing near living in the seat of where all of this was happening, first of all. So they had tasters, but there was not enough to be able to uproot and reconfigure the established system of their own lives and living and thought, right? Another way of saying it is the Alliance was not enough to effect a paradigm shift in their societies. What the Alliance in Aleppo, for example, the Alliance came and the rabbis did not allow the boys to attend the Alliance. Only girls were allowed to attend the Alliance. And my grandmother attended. And so what she spoke French. That was about it. She spoke French and she read poetry and literature, as opposed to my grandfather who didn't. You know, he wasn't allowed to go. Hatarat Nidarim language is quite similar to Ashkenazi and Kal Nidarim. Yes, because they had similar roots. Are the Safra schools in was it South Africa? Tova, I'm assuming, following Sephardi Ashkenazi.
South America.
Sorry?
Safra school in South America.
And South America. I don't know. I don't know enough about them. I apologize. I'm not sure. Yes, same in Holland. Yes, thank you. Lisa Berger, can you briefly describe different Jewish learning styles between Ashkenazi and Sephardi? One thing that I will say is that the Sephardi style of learning, and look, even among the Sephardim, there are differences. Right, but what I'll say ultimately, you know, as part of the Spanish Portuguese Western Sephardi approach, classical Sephardi approach, Maimonidean approach, yeah, Andalusian approach, which is what I'm teaching, is an integrative system, right, and where the world is integrated into Torah, and that we see the world as an elaborate expression of God, rather than an elaborate distraction of God. And something that we have to constantly caution ourselves from engaging with. But that's, again, very broad general strokes. So please, in all of these things, when I talk about systems of learning and styles, please take it with a grain of salt, like a big, big chunky grain of kosher salt, because it requires much more nuance than the way that I'm putting it out. Do different Sephardi communities cooperate in terms of education? It depends on the Sephardi communities. Some Sephardi communities don't like to cooperate with others. And that's, you know, grandfathered in. Recordings are posted. Thank you. Do you consider yourself to have been Ashkenazid? I would like to think that if I have been, it is for the better, right? But what I mean by that is I don't feel that I have been influenced to a point in where I've lost my identity as a Sephardic Jew, where I've lost my sense of being and culture and philosophy. An approach as a Sephardic Jew. But I do think that I have been enhanced as a Jew by experiencing Ashkenazi learning, Ashkenazi teaching, Ashkenazi customs and thought. I don't believe that we should be isolated from these things. I believe that we should be respectful of the difference and be able to learn and incorporate various elements, but at the same time, not necessarily lose ourselves as a result of it. And when I say lose ourselves, I mean lose our sense of identity and origin and philosophy. I hope that answers. Where did I get my smicha? I got my smicha at the Sephardic Rabbinical College in Brooklyn, which was under the auspices at the time of the Chief Rabbinate of Israel. So the tests that I took were given by the Chief Rabbinate of Israel and also by my grandfather-in-law, Rav Avadya Yosef. Difference between Syrian, does the Bar Chai represent the Sephardi system of learning? It represents the Sephardi system of learning in the way that we teach, yes, in the way that we teach Mikra, because remember, it's an elementary school. So the students learn all five books of the Torah as a basis for all of their Torah learning, right? So that the Mikra and the reading of it, the clear, the appropriate pronunciation, the trup, as you would say, the ta'amim, as you would say, are all taught to the children from Bereshit till the end of Devarim by the time they're 11 years old. And in addition to that, all of the secular studies that they learn, quote unquote secular, I don't consider them as such, are taught within a framework of Torah, right? And what does that mean? It means that they see it as a way of coming to know God and better understanding of Torah and so on. So we don't look at the secular studies that they did. And when I was there, and certainly continues till today, they don't look at secular studies as something that we kind of have to stick in to the curriculum, you know, at the expense of Torah learning. It's all part of a wholesome system of being aware of God's world and our place in it. They could have spoken to the Chazon Ish in Hebrew. The Chazon Ish was royally not interested in speaking in Hebrew for whatever reason at the time. Perhaps he wasn't necessarily comfortable in the flow of dialogue and the nuance and language that would need to be had in order to be able to create a proper union and establish a clear vision, which is what I would imagine. The community opposed the establishment of Magen David because they thought that it would take too much resource from the community, would cost too much, and they were just fine sending their kids to public school, as we call it in the States. And they figured that Talmud Torah would be enough. But in the end, thankfully, it won out. 1960s thought, Flavor was not religious because they famously took up their kippah when they went to the school building, when they left the school building, yeah. All right. Rabbi, so with that, I thank
can
you.
Can I quickly ask you, if I may?
Sure.
Is there a Baal Teshuva movement in the Sephardic world, the way in the Ashkenazic world, in many ways, you know, I would say in an atypical shul, 25 to 30% of people today daven in Orthodox shuls are Baal Teshuva.
Depends what you mean by a movement. There is a strong element among Eastern Sephardic Jews, and I think this is complex as well as to why it is this way, right? That yes, are Chozer B'Tshuva, were Chozer B'Tshuva, continue to be Chozer B'Tshuva on a very spiritual level, right? On a very emotive level rather than an intellectual level. And I think that there are definitely rabbis in Israel anyway that kind of have positioned themselves as these leaders, right? Leaders of tshuva movement. So there is, but it's very much based in, it's very much based in spiritual emotive aspects of life.
I mean, it could.
That's what it speaks to.
Might it be because in general, the Sephardim are more traditional than Ashkenazim, the non-religious Sephardim.
Well, again, I can reduce everything down to the Enlightenment again, but I really do think that it plays a part because, look, Professor Soloveitchik also put this in, and I mentioned this in my paper. And I say this only in a matter-of-fact way, not in any critical way. To the degree that one is not educated, right, formally, or at least educated in a way that, and what I mean by educated is given a systematic view of explaining the nature of reality, what we fit into that as human beings in the gaps of not having that system are beliefs that tend to be superstitious, magical, not necessarily reasonable. And we do that as human beings, not as Jews. We do that all over, right? And so that has some aspect. And when you say traditional, it's traditional, yes, but it's, why wouldn't Ashkenazim be traditional? What is it about, Ashkenazi approach or Sephardi approach that is or isn't traditional? I think a tremendous amount has to do with the nature of how it is that the Enlightenment affected thought and approach to reality in those worlds.
I mean, Ellen is pointing out, right, very interesting. There really is not a conservative or reform movement. It never developed in the Spartan world. That's
the reason for that is because we didn't have a response.
Right. There was no reason to develop.
But there is a tshuva. So
it didn't develop orthodoxy either. There's no such thing.
Correct. Which is why, you know, those are not terms that we really use in our synagogues, you know. But, you know, there's much more that can be discussed with regards to that. But, yeah.
Very good. Okay, we'll leave some for next week and maybe other weeks. It's 12:05. So thank you very much.